I remember, for instance, during the pandemic, group of charity leaders, we're sitting around and we're talking in our respective homes around the country, thinking about the things that are important. And even just things like we had to lobby the government and we won to make sure that people with serious mental illness were in the early cohorts for the vaccine. People with serious mental illness often die 20 years before everybody else. And that is a global fact, but a fact in a country that has universal healthcare is one that shouldn't be happening.
Hello and welcome to the Truth, Lies and Workplace Culture podcast, brought to you by the HubSpot Podcast Network, the audio destination for business professionals. My name is Leanne, I'm a business psychologist.
My name is Al, I'm a business owner.
We are here to help you simplify the science of people and create amazing workplace cultures.
Yep, and as part of our series of amazing guests, we have an incredible one for you today. I think we've talked a lot about mental health, but there's a reason, because it is really, really quite importantly, isn't it?
Yes.
Good. Well, now we've got that. There you go. There's the definitive answer from a business psychologist. Yes, it is important. For those of you who aren't in the UK, you may not have heard of Mind. It's a large, very large organization in the UK. Don't worry, there's plenty of stuff for you, because there's going to be something similar to you to Mind in your country, but also the problems, I think, are they span countries, continents. No matter where you are in the world, it's going to be the similar kind of issues.
Yeah, mental health is a human condition, isn't it? None of us are immune to it or immune to adverse mental health challenges. It impacts everybody. And the great thing about Mind is they have loads of really great online resources as well that you can access wherever you are in the world. So do check it out. Genuine question, Al.
Go ahead.
When was the last time you experienced decent, not even like exceptional, just decent customer service?
Oh, long time ago.
I mean, there's no secret formula for it yet. What we do know is that most companies seem to be pretty bad at it. But not you, my friend. Not you, listener. Oh, no. You can create an amazing customer service experience when you use the brand new Service Hub from HubSpot.
Yep, this all-new Service Hub from HubSpot brings customer service and support together in one simple but powerful platform, so you can deliver the best experience possible. And of course, it's powered by AI, not Al, AI, meaning your team can automate those tedious tickets from people who've clearly not read your frequently asked questions. Pain in the backside, aren't they? Oh, and by the way, organizations using HubSpot Service Hub are resolving tickets 13 times faster, helping them to close 42% more tickets per day. That means increasing retention by more than 80%. Thank you, people at HubSpot who did the maths on that one, because I wouldn't be able to.
I love a bit of data. Did you also know, Al, that it consolidates your entire internal knowledge base into one place? So no matter who is working on support, they'll have the answers at their fingertips.
I did know that because I wrote that for you.
Well, there you have it. Stand out from the crowd and migrate to HubSpot Service Hub today.
Visit HubSpot.com/service. And learn how this all-new solution can help you deliver for your customers.
So yes, we are talking today to Dr. Sarah Hughes. She is joining us. She is the Chief Executive of Mind, a leading mental health campaigning organisation in the UK. With a career spanning over 35 years in mental health, Sarah brings a wealth of experience and insight to our discussion. She has been at the helm of Mind for over a year now, celebrating her one-year anniversary just a few weeks ago. Before her current role, Sarah has dedicated 2 decades to leadership positions across various mental health charities, profoundly impacting the sector. As a trained social worker, her journey in mental health advocacy and support is not just professional, but a personal commitment to advancing mental health conversations and policies. Today, she shares her journey, the evolution of mental health perceptions, and the challenges and triumphs of advocating for better mental health care and support systems. Join us as we delve into an enlightening conversation with Sarah, exploring the depths of mental health advocacy and the impact, the wonderful, impactful work Mind is doing across the nation. Let's meet Sarah.
I'm Sarah, and I'm Chief Executive of Mind at the moment, and I've been Chief Exec for a year. In fact, I celebrated my 1 year anniversary last week. But I've worked in mental health for 35 years and very proudly so. And I'm a trained social worker. I've been a chief exec for 20 years now in five mental health charities.
So as mentioned before, for those of you not in the UK, let's just get right into the nitty gritty of what Mind actually does.
Yeah, so Mind is a mental health campaigning organisation. I think people will know us primarily for that. We have, led the nation's evolution around mental health for about a decade, although we're 75 years old, maybe 80 years old now. And we've got 108 local minds across the country that deliver services. And we've got 170 very famous charity shops as well. So we do a huge amount. We fundraise for mental health. We campaign. We influence policy decisions. So, you know, it's us that kind of get mental health additional funding. You know, we work really hard with our partners to negotiate all of that. So we've got our fingers in all of the mental health pies.
I'm sure you've seen that mental health is much more at the forefront of the conversation these days. Years ago, mental health was something you would never really talk about publicly, let alone with your boss. But thanks to Sarah and organisations like Mind, the perception has changed quite significantly.
I have worked in mental health for 35 years, and it's true to say that when I first started, you know, there was no way we could talk about mental health in the way that we do now. There was no conversations between friends. There weren't conversations in families. There certainly wasn't conversations in workplaces. And even those of us who worked in mental health, you know, you couldn't really tell people because, you know, there was a sort of almost disdain and weird reaction. So to be, you know, 35 years later in an organisation that has really change the conversation is quite an extraordinary thing, that we're talking about it in schools, we're talking about it in pubs, in barbers, in workplaces. You know, that's absolutely true. What I would say, though, is whilst our literacy has definitely improved, would I hand on my heart say people experiencing serious mental illness would say, you know, we're getting the best services ever, we're getting access when we need it, all of those things. I think some people would say yes, but I think there'd be a lot of people that would say no. And so the job is nowhere near done. Progress, yes, but we're not anywhere near where we need to be. It's been probably the most worrying 5 years. You know, there's no doubt about it. We've actually had quite a long time of global volatility, of financial stress and pressure. You know, before the pandemic, we had austerity, you know, so all of these things have eroded mental health. And so what we know is that there is an increase in prevalence. There is an increase in people seeking help for their mental health. I always have to be really careful, though, and this is some of the issues around language and how we think about things now, that I don't want to pathologize the nation, you know, so we're not all mentally ill. You know, we've all got mental health, but we're not all mentally ill. There is a spectrum that, you know, some of us travel up and down. Some of us who experience very serious mental illness exist in a different world often from everybody else because of their experience is so different. So we often merge the two together, mental health and mental illness, and that often can leave people with mental illness aside. So whilst I acknowledge that the prevalence has increased, we've also got to understand that within that group of people that are experiencing deterioration in their mental health, that there will be people that will be worse off than others, even within that group.
Just as a quick note, if you are watching on YouTube, then unfortunately our technology let us down, so we've only got half of Sarah's video, but don't worry, we've got all the audio. So if you do see just a lovely picture of Sarah, it's because we didn't quite capture that audio. Anyway, as a busy leader, it is hard to keep up with the changes in public perception. So Dr. Sarah pointed out that there are still serious misconceptions about mental health.
There's still a huge lack of understanding about what the experience of serious mental illness is. So for those people who are being sectioned under the Mental Health Act, for those people who are in and out of psychiatric hospitals, those people who are experiencing community care, who are in supported housing. And I do often worry that that the conversation tends to move towards a more sort of mild to moderate discussion around mental health. And I think that actually what I understand from our feedback that we get from the public is that they're now ready to understand the whole spectrum of mental health. And actually the experience that people with more serious mental illness have is often the most difficult in terms of inequality, in terms of poor outcomes and so on. And actually when we've started talking about that more publicly, people have been astonished and outraged, and that's what we need. That's what we need people to be.
One of the biggest challenges recently is to get the government to acknowledge that mental health needs to be prioritised. The Mental Health Act in the UK was originally created over 40 years ago to determine what should happen if someone exhibits signs of deteriorating mental health. It is full of recommendations around sectioning, and Sarah and her colleagues are determined to get this updated so it becomes more about helping those with poor mental health than detaining them.
You know, quite a lot of the mental illness that we see being experienced by communities across the country are caused by things that we could prevent. So poverty, racism, discrimination, poor education, bullying, domestic violence, bad housing. All of these things could be within our gift to solve. And so from my perspective, it's about saying, you know, well, why aren't we preventing mental illness when we know the things that could help make a difference? Well, funding for services isn't at the level that it should be. You know, there is just not, we haven't achieved parity of esteem, which is this notion of equity between physical and mental health. We haven't got there. And we know that things like psychiatric hospitals, you know, they're not in a, you know, the establishment, the environment is not good enough. You know, if you're somebody in mental health crisis and being sectioned under the Mental Health Act and you get taken into an inpatient ward, often those environments are nowhere near conducive enough to good mental health or recovery. So, you know, I think that that's where we need to be prioritising our attention. We need to be preventing the mental illness that we know is caused by social factors. We need to be enabling people to access the support when they need it. And we need them to get the right care at the right time from the right people. And I think all of those things need to happen in concert with each other, because sometimes we get a bit of the system right, but not the rest of the system. So I'll give you an example. If you're in a psychiatric ward and you become, you know, you recover while you're on that psychiatric ward, but you want to be discharged to a, you know, new environment or supported living, and there is not enough accommodation out there, you end up sitting on the ward for a lot longer than you need to.
It's absurd to think that there are still laws around mental health and mental health support that were created 40 years ago. The world was a very different place 40 years ago. So yeah, it's crazy that is even time that needs to be spent by Mind and Sarah and her team to update those laws. It seems like in any other industry or sector or area that wouldn't be tolerated.
Yeah, totally agree. I mean, I think to be honest, the conversation's changed over the last 40 months, let alone the last 40 years. So yes, we definitely and desperately need some new legislation surrounding this so that it can actually support rather than, like we said before, detain or deal with people who, God knows what we did 40 years ago. I'm pretty sure that was electric shock sort of era. Or maybe not quite. Maybe I'm just thinking of a Milgram experiment. Now, this all might sound like a nice to have and something that needs to be done, but in actual fact, it's costing us business owners actually quite a lot of money. So even if you can't quite get your head around why it's so important, which I understand, this is a journey for all of us to understand this, it's important to understand that it's actually costing you cash every single month, and it will continue to cost you money unless you actually do something about it.
For instance, in the workplace, the cost of mental illness is around £56 billion a year. So the economic case is very strong. It's very strong in terms of if we don't invest in prevention and people, you know, people find out often if they have mental illness or they're going to experience mental illness before the age of 25. So as a result of that, you know, we know that if we could invest early, get people into services and support when they need it, we can get them back into thriving lives. So again, it's about, you know, then people can become part of their communities. We can see relationships and the economy blooming. You know, it means everything. And the idea that physical and mental health are not equally important is something that I've never understood personally. You know, for me, it's always made sense to me that they're inextricably linked. But we do so much in terms of our policy and our funding decisions that separates them off. And as a result of that, we are disadvantaging the nation's mental and physical health. People with serious mental illness often die 20 years before everybody else. And that is a global fact. But a fact in a country that has universal healthcare is one that shouldn't be happening.
Some of the more progressive and perhaps braver leaders are starting to share their own experiences with mental health, but there's still some way to go. I asked Sarah why more leaders don't share their personal experiences.
I think so. I think it's very rare that people haven't had any. So, and I say that because it's not just about themselves. It could be in their families or, you know, workplaces, whatever. I think we've all got that experience. I think it's fear. I think it's fear about disclosing. We still carry a lot of shame about being ill, or there is still a stigma attached. No matter how well we talk about it in society, we are still vulnerable. And I think open to people misunderstanding and so on. And so I think I understand the fear, and I see more and more leaders speak about it all the time, both inside mental health and in across the charity sector. I mean, you know, a friend of mine, Karen Bradshaw, who's chief executive of the Charity Finance Group, recently wrote a blog about saying, you know, I've just taken some time out because my mental health was bad. And, you know, I think that is hugely, it's still a brave thing to do. And until it becomes a natural thing to do and we don't have to be so brave, I think more people will do it. But until then, it's still a bit scary.
In a moment, Sarah's going to share her own experiences of mental health. But before that, I have to bring up those pesky Gen Zers. Once again, it feels like they're the ones who are stirring this all up. Now, is this mental health just something the younger generations care about, or is it more of a broader conversation?
No. And it's funny, actually, because I've got my own Gen Z. I've got my own kid. And we have these discussions all the time. And it's really, really interesting. And some of it is this kind of generational tension between expectations of each other, expectations in the workplace. And all these things are really evolving. And we haven't got the language right. I mean, and the concept of being woke or not, being a snowflake or not, all of these terms are a way of dividing us. Because actually, you know, I get this sense from you as well, that actually being woke is a good thing, because actually, essentially, it means you know stuff and you're compassionate. That's what I think it means. But of course, it is weaponized. And so all of this language, I think we've got to work hard, certainly as a sector, as a leader, as a human being, just out in the world, to not collude with it. And just to kind of try and enter into discussion. Why are there differences between us rather than you're right and I'm wrong? This is an evolution. We're all learning. And I think, yeah, this war of words, this culture war around snowflakery is, I think it's a red herring. I think it takes us away from actually focusing on what the issues are, which is social injustice. You know, that's actually what we're talking about. You know, not whether people care about the social injustice or not.
Now, hold on a minute. Sarah just used the term social injustice, and I hadn't heard that term before, so I wanted to find out a bit more about what that actually meant.
Well, it's such a great question, actually, because almost all of the corporate organisations that we've worked with over the years have very much had this kind of creeping interest in the social justice agenda, which often is couched in equality and diversity and inclusion. But actually what we're talking about is fairness, is dignity, respect, equity. I just think people are ready for a bit more nuance. I think it's very difficult, you know, the social media. If you were just having conversations on social media, then it would feel very divisive. But actually, when you're talking to people in communities, in businesses, that's what people want. People want to live thriving lives. And I think that when we're saying, well, that's great, but you know that many people are just about surviving, and they're just about surviving because they're living in poverty, or, you know, they're experiencing racism and discrimination that's, you know, exploding their mental health and causing all sorts of other consequences on their families, on their physical health. I think people care about that.
One of the biggest challenges that the younger generations have is that every problem in the world is documented on social media. That means they are bombarded with bad news all day long. So how can they stay abreast of the world news without getting overwhelmed?
So firstly, I think that there is something about staying informed from the right places. So I think part of what I want people to do, especially young people, is curate their input, you know, their social media feed, so that they're getting good information about stuff. Because I think just this constant deluge of information can be very overwhelming, and getting accurate information about things can be very difficult to do. I think that we have to help our young people, you know, because even though I was a staunch activist from a very young age, I didn't know half of what was going on in the world. But our young people know it all, and they're expected to care about it all. And I think we have to enable young people to find some sanctuary away from distress. And that is very difficult to do, because we all want what's happening in the world to stop, and, you know, all the bad stuff to stop. But I think that, you know, we need to enable our young people to self-care, to say, okay, you know, there is this that I'm going to focus on. But then there is the other thing that I think is very important, is actually to get involved in something. So it's a kind of not the antithesis of me saying curate your feed and manage your self-care. It's an extension of that, really, because often engaging in campaigning or engaging with a community that is working on a project to look at X, Y or Y is incredibly powerful and really good for your mental health, because effectively we're social beings. So being with other people, even for those people who are introverts or who say they like being at home, we're effectively social beings. That being with people on things that you care about, that things that you can do together, is a huge, huge mitigator of mental illness.
One of the coolest things about Sarah is that she's not some stuffy suit in a boardroom pontificating about how things should be. She's not only worked in mental health and the care sector for decades, but she's very open about her own mental health struggles.
Well, it's funny, actually, because mental health is my life's work. And the reason being is because primarily I came from a family where, you know, people that I loved experienced mental illness. As I got older, I experienced my own mental illness. I still do at various points in my life. And so I know deeply how poor mental health can just, it's like a nuclear bomb into families. It can be a nuclear bomb into your lives, but it can also bring great joy, empathy, compassion, knowledge, wisdom. And so with all of that together, I just felt like it was a natural place for me to be. And I've always worked in charities. And the reason why, again, is because I feel like it's closer to communities. It's closer to where people live and where it makes the most difference. And I guess going into senior leadership, I realised quite early on that there's probably not many people like me in leadership positions that hold their own lived experience so openly and maybe at the heart of their decision making. So I thought I'd give it a go. And ever since, I've felt deeply committed. And even in the small wins, you know, I remember, for instance, during the pandemic, group of charity leaders, we're sitting around and we're talking in our respective homes around the country, thinking about the things that are important. And, you know, even just things like we had to lobby the government and we won to make sure that people with serious mental illness were in the early cohorts for the vaccine. And, you know, just knowing that we had done that, you know, and that thing wouldn't have happened if we didn't do that bit of campaigning. So we know that in that act, in that kind of, you know, prioritizing people's needs, that we're able to make a difference. And it's those things that drive me, and our local minds and what we're doing and what we're seeing, the change we're making. It's all that counts, really.
Navigating the world of leadership as a woman brings its unique challenges and opportunities, something Dr. Sarah Hughes knows all too well. She shares her personal experiences of being a woman in a leadership position, the evolution of workplace norms, and the ongoing quest for true diversity and inclusion in the charity sector.
But I also remember what I was like when I entered the workplace. And the amount of raised eyebrows that I would get around a table, you know, the amount of times that I was told off for not wearing a suit, the amount of times I got told off for, you know, having a tattoo or not talking properly or all of these kind of things, you know. And I just think, so I resist as much of that as possible in terms of how I am now as the boss. But I also recognize that, you know, it's actually not that easy. You know, you can't underestimate that generational transition. And I think it's only through having honest conversations and talking it through that, you know, that you can kind of get past the tension. So we have a lot of women leaders in the charity sector, but there are more chief executives that are called, I think it's David, in the UK than there are women. And I think that's true. I don't think we have a lot of diverse women in the charity sector. So, you know, black women leaders, disabled women leaders, I think we're quite far away from that. But it's still heavily dominated, you know, in terms of, you know, funding institutions, who we talk to in terms of government, corporates, etc. So yes, it is. I'm very much of the mind that we all work in kind of white supremacist sort of frameworks, which include very traditional views of men and women and leadership and the way we talk to each other and, you know, how we communicate on all sorts of different things. And so as a result of that, we're all operating in a way that challenges the idea of diversity in leadership, and we haven't dismantled it yet. We still bump up against it. So I recently spoke about being a working class leader, and it's still a thing. It just is. And for us to say that it isn't is just not, it's not true. I do think the language of feminism gets locked into a different place that I don't really understand or try and engage into much. You know, where I'm at is my leadership is about inclusion, is about understanding the environment in which we operate and responding accordingly.
I am quickly interrupting this phenomenal podcast to recommend another phenomenal podcast, Nudge. We love Nudge, hosted by Phil Agnew, a true gent. It is, of course, brought to you by the HubSpot Podcast Network, the audio destination for business professionals. But that is not the only reason we're recommending it, is it, Al?
No, it's not. No, we've recommended it to lots of people. In fact, if you look at any of our YouTube comments, it won't take you long, there's about 20 of them, then you'll see that we recommend Phil to anyone who likes our pod. Well, on Nudge, you're going to learn simple evidence-backed tips. It's going to help you kick bad habits, get a raise, and grow a business. Oh, and it's the UK's fastest growing business podcast.
For now.
For now, Phil, we're coming for you, buddy.
If you loved hearing Rory Sutherland from Ogilvy on our show back in episode 83, then Phil's latest episode has Rory on again, talking about McDonald's, smoking, and why the pension system is broken.
I suppose we should say that actually Rory's been on a couple of times on To Nudge. It's not that Phil's seen what we've done and gone, I'll have Rory. So I think it's important
for us
to say that.
Yeah, no, we copied Phil. Anyway, listen to Nudge wherever you get your podcasts.
Sarah's ability to eloquently articulate ideas and insistence on being part of the conversation has sometimes earned her the description of being an annoying woman, usually by white middle-aged men. Instead of getting upset about this, Sarah wears the annoying woman badge with pride. It's even on her Twitter profile.
Well, I mean, it was in response, I think, was it Donald Trump who called somebody an annoying woman or somebody here? No, it was one of the politicians here. Anyway, there was a time when women who spoke out were being called annoying. And I think pretty much we still are called annoying. And I take pride in my sometimes being an annoying woman, partly because that social justice piece is very important to me as a human being. I feel deeply motivated by what I see happening in the world, what I experience myself. And sometimes I think I'm provocative. I say things sometimes I probably shouldn't say. I've got a bit better at that as I've got older, but still sometimes creeps out. And, you know, I mean, and this is the thing, women, when you're considered difficult, it's a really interesting way of closing you down. And I think by owning the fact that, yes, we're difficult and disruptive because there's a necessity, and I'm not going to allow that view to undermine the point that I'm making as a woman. And I've got a lot of annoying women friends, and I think they're the best type.
Okay, so you know by now it's my job is to take all this stuff and make it practical for the business owner. So how can Mind help you and your business?
So we at Mind, we've got the mental health at work commitments that we do in partnership with a lot of corporates. We run our mental health index so that people can sort of assess where they are in terms of, you know, whether they deliver on the mental health agenda or not. I think that it's joining up with communities. So joining up with, you know, there are many workplace wellbeing networks. So MAD Wellbeing, one of them. There are many others. There is Mind Forward Alliance. There is Mental Health First Aid. There is what we do. And again, there are others. And I think corporates being part of that, I think, is a start. Many corporate organisations are quite a long way on their journey. And I think that we should applaud some of our corporate partners for the progress that they've made. And I don't think we should underestimate that, because I've seen astonishing progress in, you know, corporate world in a way that, you know, even some of our charity organisations would not have made. So I think it's being part of those networks. It's facing up to the truth of what goes on in your organisations. It's about, you know, understanding what your workforce needs and what they're saying. And I think this is becoming custom and practice, I think, in lots of places. And I wouldn't say it's a job done, but I think I've seen more progress than I would have thought. I think there are organisations like John Lewis. I think they're, you know, it's very famous for the support that they provide for their organisations. I think that Unilever as well, another organisation very well known for all of the support that they deliver within their organisation. So I think there are good examples, and you know, we can definitely share more of those. And we have award systems. And again, you know, many awards are offered to organisations. You can see it all the time in different places. And I think this is a good thing. This is progress. It's not always performative. And I think sometimes people worry about that. But, you know, small steps can lead to big strides.
A lot of business owners we talk to are frustrated about the number of people who don't engage with their EAPs or employee assistance programs. An employee assistance program, if you haven't heard of it, is a workplace benefit program designed usually to provide confidential support and resources to employees facing personal or work-related challenges. So it can offer things like counselling, mental health support, legal assistance, financial counselling, and referrals to other professional services organisations. Some EAPs also include things like shopping vouchers, gym membership, online GP appointments, that type of things. EAPs can be really valuable for a number of reasons. Firstly, they do provide that confidential support. They encourage employees to seek assistance without that fear of judgment or negative repercussions. And this confidentiality fosters early intervention. So it helps employees address issues before they escalate to a really serious level. So by offering access to counselling and support services, EAPs can improve mental health, reduce stress, and help employees cope with personal and work-related challenges. This in turn, of course, as you well know by now, listener, is going to lead to increased productivity, increased job satisfaction and overall well-being among employees. It also sounds like really good stuff, right? Well, it is. But as we learnt last week speaking to Bruce Daisley, an emphasis on individual level interventions can cause more damage than good if an employee is operating in a toxic work environment. As Bruce explained, it could be seen as victim blaming. So this could be one of the reasons that uptakes in EAPs are typically low. But as Dr. Sarah explains, there may be other factors at play.
Partly, EAP services are really great, but often people will not feel like it's personalised enough to them. So I think sometimes that's the struggle with EAP, that it feels a little bit kind of general and, you know, not personal, etc. So I think that's some of the struggle. I think sometimes EAPs are not always culturally appropriate, or they're not, you know, effective for people with neurodiversity. So sometimes it's about the quality of the offer. And that's not a denigration on EAP at all, because I think it's very good practice to have one. But I think that sometimes, you know, we're all doing it at scale, that we forget actually it's individuals that are accessing those support systems, and individuals have individual needs. So there's that. I also think we can't underestimate stigma. So again, whilst I would say a lot of progress has been made, I still think there are a huge number of people who would say, I am no way near ready to disclose my mental illness in the workplace. I don't feel safe to do that. So I think there's a combination of factors about why people don't access support. But I would urge organisations not to stop. What I would urge organisations to do is examine the offer and see if it's something else. And also, I think, and this is something, you know, ultimately, you can provide a lot of well-being support, but if people are still being overworked or underpaid, you know, well-being support is not going to offset those. So sometimes the decision is, you know, can I pay my workforce a bit of a better wage, or do I invest in EAP? I think those things are for you to discuss with your workforce, especially if you're an SME. You can't just drop in a well-being program into a business and hope for the best, because it's about everything else. It's essentially about the culture. It's about people's ability to disclose. It's about the quality of the offer of, you know, EAP and all of those sorts of things. It's fundamentally if people feel like they've got good work, that they're in a fair environment, that they've got good line management. Those are the things that I think I have seen make the biggest difference in well-being. So getting the basics right, I think above everything else, has to be the priority. I think wellness initiatives do work, and they work for people's holistic health. The reality is that if you're considering wellness as a response to emerging mental illness, then that's not the right thing. And so I think it's about workplaces really understanding the difference between mental health and then when people become ill. So I think it's about growing your understanding and moving that literacy into a really much more sophisticated approach to supporting people's mental and physical health in the workplace. So wellness is important. I agree, though, that it's only part of the pie that will make the tangible differences to people's working lives.
There's a lot of EAPs out there to choose from. Our personal favourite is Pirkx, P-I-R-K-X, run by the amazing Stella Smith. Such good value, such amazing things you get from it. Something we use here, even though there's only two of us, we use here. And if anyone asks about an EAP, then we always recommend to go and look up Stella Smith. So look in the show notes, P-I-R-K-X, not being paid to say that.
Man, if we did.
Yeah, Stella, if you're listening, you need to pay us to say that.
Mind is an incredible organization, and Dr. Sarah Hughes is an amazing woman. If you want to get involved with Mind, then Sarah has a few ideas of where to start.
So we've got, you can go to our pages, our web pages, and there's a whole ream of things. You can be an ambassador, you can be a fundraiser, you can be a campaigner, you can be one of our facilitators, you can join some of our volunteer programs, you can volunteer in our shops, you know, you can do all sorts of things. You can help us make sure that your workplace gets the, you know, mental health at work commitments. You know, there are all sorts of things that people can do. It's not just all about donating a fiver. You know, there are, although people donating a fiver is very, very welcome, but, you know, it's all about spreading the word of Mind. That piece about, you know, we can prevent some of the mental illness that we're seeing, and it's not impossible to provide people with good care. And, you know, we want people to be sharing that message, get behind the movement, campaign, lobby their MP, tell their local, you know, commissioning group that fund all of the healthcare. You know, we want them to get involved, have their say, fight for mental health.
Well, there you have it. I hope you have a better understanding of what Mind is and the work they do, but also a better understanding of Dr. Sarah Hughes. Definitely go and check out her LinkedIn. She's very prolific. What's the word when you write a lot? Prolific writer. There you go. She's very prolific on LinkedIn. So definitely go and check that out. And she's also done lots of amazing other interviews on other podcasts.
You've thrown out some vocab today, Al. Don't think I missed pontification before.
Pontification.
I heard that.
That's to make a bridge out of something. Pontification.
What did I say?
Pontification. I don't know what pontification is.
What is it?
Pontification.
It sounds exactly the same. You're saying the same word.
I'm saying it right.
Say it again.
Pontification.
Pontification. What did I say?
Pontification.
I said pontification.
You're putting the emphasis on the wrong bit of the word. Anyway, check out the show notes for links to Dr. Sarah's profiles and to find out more about her.
Yes, and before we go, let's just remind ourselves of the importance of talking about all this stuff.
You know, without doubt, the difference that we've made to society as a whole mental health community, which is effectively built on the shoulders of people with lived experience, that, you know, we've spoken about mental health and we've increased the conversation. But now we really need to help people get to the next stage and not get locked into this kind of, you know, idea that mental health is just this, and forget about the people with more serious, enduring, life-threatening conditions.
Thank you to our guest today, the incredible Dr. Sarah Hughes, Chief Executive of Mind. Thank you for listening. If you are enjoying the show, get in touch. You'll find us on LinkedIn. Leave us a review. That's always nice. Or you can call Al directly on 07703.
Whoa. No, do not call me. I tell you what, even if you message me on LinkedIn, then I won't answer. Leanne was horrified the other day because she opened my LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. She logged into my LinkedIn and saw there was about 60 new connection requests. So if you have sent a connection request to me, I'm sorry. It's nothing to do with you. I'm just grumpy and I just like not talking to anyone, which is not great seeing as I'm the sales and marketing guy.
You're a content creator. It's
I type not talk. There you go. There's a domain for you. Type not talk. Anyway, so we will see you next week for another amazing guest. As Leanne said, do get onto LinkedIn and search for Truth, Lies and Work, because you'll find that there's a page there that Leanne is very active on. And what's more important is it's your way to talk to us. There isn't really a way, unless you use Spotify, and I don't know how to use that Q&A thing, but there's no real way for you to talk back to us, and we really want your feedback. So if you've enjoyed it, if you've hated it, if you think that we're rubbish, if you think that we sound a bit sexier now since post-COVID and we've both got a bit of a deeper voice, so you really want to just get some ASMR going, then get onto LinkedIn, let us know what you think, because it's really, really important to us. It's lovely us recording this, but we do record it just to a camera, so we don't get that two-way interaction, so be really, really good. What are you doing there, Lee?
ASMR.
So what's
it called?
BDSM, I think.
BDSM
is the word. Yes. So next time you're in a meeting, use the word BDSM. That's what it means.
Yes. Next week. Who've we got on the show next week, Al?
Yes.
Yes.
I've forgotten. I knew you were going to ask it. I should have checked. We've got an amazing guest on next week. Let's leave it at that. It's a surprise for everyone, including us.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye. and the ongoing quest for true diversity and inclusivity in the charity sector. I couldn't get that out, sorry.
That's good. I mean, do it again if you want, but...
Inclusivity. Struggle with that word.
Struggle with a lot of words, Lee. Like, no thanks, I don't want another glass of wine.